for reasons many would why. And some, though their lives were milestones in the pursuit of human freedom, go unrecorded and unsung.
You know, you nitze.
Misrepresented or not written at all. In spite of these injustices, there frequently appears on the historical scene ideas so compelling, persons so pervasive, that they will not be obscured. Such a man is our subject. Abolitionist, journalist, orator, freedom fighter, a prime mover in the most crucial period of the American Negro's struggle for freedom. We present Frederick Douglass, hoping that in this brief sketch you may gain a glimpse of the spirit and fiber of one of the greatest of all Americans.
Maryland, 1817. A child is born. Frederick Douglass. Month, February. Day, unknown. For when is it important to record the birth of a slave? Maryland, breeding state of the Union. It was lucky if a child lived. Maryland, where Douglass existed as a child, but was not to remain one long. At 11, he was not only standing the terrible endurance of living without food and without mother and father, but he was asking questions. And to ask good questions means to be going towards an answer. But answers are many times a long way off. Douglass spent 20 years of his life in slavery. Life of a slave so difficult to endure is not easily forgotten. He speaks of this inhuman life with unrivaled reality. Listen to the words of a slave.
Pastor Wilson of the Gallant South, the Bojangles sent a magnolia. And the sudden smell of burning flesh. For the rain together, and for the wind.
David! Robin!
And I looked up and
was
there
for the sun to rise. So we had a happy reunion.
For the tree.
And we were all very excited.
And
it turned out that it was kind of dry.
Under such conditions, one would expect to find many revolts and escapes, and the record shows that there were many. Douglass made his escape after the second try. New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island were soon to hear from this man, bearing the marks of slavery, not accepting, always asking, and now finding new answers not yet heard. He attended anti-slavery meetings, met people who enlarged his horizon, and fired his imagination. It was a short while, under the most intense conditions, that Douglass was not only reading and writing, but doing it well enough to be in great demand as a lecturer and orator. 1850 was not only the period of great debate, but of the great debaters. Douglass blended his skills in with other illustrious men of this period. Whitman, John Brown, William Lloyd Garrison, Wendell Phillips, and Charles Sumner, abolitionists all. And Douglass hurled one of his mightiest challenges, the abolition. rapidly reaching new levels, and Douglas, like he always did, never seeing only one thing, but seeing always the whole of something, knew that America was not alone in the world. He went to England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, and for the first time brought slavery into international focus. Official slavery living through its last decade was putting up a most desperate battle. Harriet Tubman, stymied but not stopped by the Fugitive Act of 1850, was continuing with the Underground Railroad. The great and irrepressible John Brown was one of Douglas's closest friends, had sacrificingly given himself at Harper's Ferry. Now the situation was white hot and fluid. The issue under debate was whether the Union should remain intact. Frederick Douglass, self-educated, a slave, knew that education was the key. A key that must be found and used if progress were to be made. There may have been those who led more illustrious lives. There may have been those who charted more spectacular careers. But show me a man who, starting under such shackled conditions, became one of the greatest influences of his day. Perhaps his most remembered words are these, given at a 4th of July oration, 1857. And it is with these words that we close a small glimpse of Frederick Douglass in pursuit of freedom.
He stepped down, and we held down, walked over to the tree. I walked over there. Looked around me, and about half the assembly was over there. At this time, it was only about 500 people. This was still the first day, very early in the first day. Other speakers were going on. Bob Parrish, Scott Murphy, Dave Dillinger. The man who started leading it, A.J. Musty, sat down in his chair. Everybody sat down in a circle. A.J. Musty on one side on the grass, and a younger man got up and started talking. Well, I was under the impression that A.J. Musty was going to lead it. This man was Eric Weinberger. Started leading it, every once in a while A.J. Musty would say something, and he was kind of a reverent leader. He never said anything, and in this heat he really didn't have the strength to talk very loud. But he was just kind of the voice of experience whenever anybody had any questions through the whole assembly.
Who is this Weinberger?
Eric Weinberger, I'm not sure. He's something in CNVA. I think he is. He was one of the leaders of the assembly throughout the entire assembly. We decided. H.A. Musty made numerous phone calls. That's what his main duty was calling the president. He got as far as a Mr. Smith. Now this Mr. Smith was Mr. Bundy's assistant, which, you know, amounted to an assistant. And we told Mr. Smith, which was as high up in the bureaucracy we could go, H.A. Musty told Mr. Smith, on behalf of us, that we had 1,000 people here, was almost 1,200 by now, that wanted to speak and present some petitions to the President of the United States. Mr. Smith offered us a compromise. President will not see all 1,200 of you, he said, but I will see a delegation of about 10. Well, this seemed so far from what we suggested and so far from what we wanted that we said we will not settle for anything less than all of us seeing the President. Mr. Smith countered for the proposal that he would come out and address all of us, but not in the White House lawn as we had asked, but out in the street. This again was not to our satisfaction. So we said that when we made this decision, we made it in a democratic way, and while we made this decision, everything was out in the open. There were newspaper men with tape recorders standing around. They were policemen in uniform, and I'm sure some not in uniform, taking notes. There were, I'm sure, some Secret Service people there. We said that we were going to cross the street to the White House and sit in front of the gate of the White House until such time as the president would come out and see us. We were immediately informed by a police officer, who later said he was a captain, that if we did this, we should be immediately subject to arrest, since it was illegal to sit down, as we would be arrested for disorderly conduct or some such trumped-up charge if we sat down in front of the White House. Eric Weinberger then said it was clear that only those dedicated to civil disobedience and only those willing to serve a 6-month term, as it has been known, should take part in this. He said that 3 times this has been attempted. Once, everybody was simply released. Another time, everybody had to put $10 down and could leave town at will, forfeiting the $10, or could come back for trial using the $10 as bail money. And another time, they got 6-month prison terms. He said anybody not willing to take the maximum charge, which has been 6 months, should not sit down there. This is very clear. At this time, I was not willing to get arrested. Mr. Weinberger made the statement that anybody under 18 should not get arrested, as this would leave everyone else there, possibly with a charge of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. He said that this would probably not be used. And also, you have very much trouble getting out of jail, and for your own convenience, you would like it, that unless your parents were there and you were under 18, would you please not get arrested unless you full well knew what you were doing. We went back then to the main assembly, which was still going on, and we found out that Joan Baez had been one of the people who had dedicated herself to civil disobedience and said that she would be one of the people that sat down. She got up on the podium and sang. She sang Stop in the Name of Love and dedicated it to President Johnson. Everybody was very full of spirit at this time, and then Eric Weinberger got up and announced what both of us around the tree had planned to do. He said that we wanted and would greatly appreciate those of you that were committed to civil disobedience to join us. Those of you who could not, please immediately join a supporting picket line. But that picket line must keep moving, or those people too will be arrested. He made this very clear. I decided I would join the supporting picket line. We went across the street. About 30 people sat down. Joan Baez, A.J. Musty, and Irving Kelman from St. Paul among them. By the time we got out over there, since because of the openness of our decision and the press people around, there was movie cameras, still cameras, TV cameras, scaffolds, and hundreds of policemen standing all around the exact spot we had decided. Immediately overhead to where they were going to sit was suspended a camera placed there by the press. They sat down. And immediately flashbulbs started popping. This went on for about a half an hour, and about 800 people started picketing in a slow picket line, singing just about every peace song, freedom song, protest song, movement song that probably has ever ever been sung in a picket line. I learned so many more, and I heard so many that I have never heard in a long time. I didn't think anybody remembered Goodbye, Mr. War, or I dreamed, last night I had the strangest dream, and I'm going to lay down my sword and shield. All these songs that I hadn't heard for the longest time, I heard here. So we were walking around and singing, and we sang With God on Our Side by Bob Dylan. We sang I Ain't Marching Anymore by Phil Oakes. It was clear. We couldn't even see the picketers. They were completely surrounded by policemen. And we were completely surrounded by policemen. Couldn't see the people who were sitting down. Suddenly, somebody from inside the picket line hollered, AJ Musty wants a drink of water. Well, we all wanted a drink of water, too. It was close to or possibly over 100 degrees, and the humidity was extremely high. Somebody walked up with a thermos and approached the picketers, and was immediately stopped by the officers. He said, I'm just taking this water to AJ Musty. You can't do that. He's 81 years old. I don't care who he is. Can't give him any water. Our orders are not to let anything through. 800 people started up a chant. Give AJ water. Give AJ water. And this person sat down as close to the picket line as he could get. With a thermos in front of him, he poured out a cup of water, set it down, set the cup of water next to the thermos, and sat down in front of it. And this stepped up for about 10 minutes until the policeman relented and said that one thermos could go in, but no more. It got in. Then it began to be 6 o'clock came. 6 o'clock was the time designated that the demonstration should halt. We didn't find out till later, but a heated discussion was going on within the sitters, people who were sitting down. It was a small group, possibly about half of the 30, that decided they wanted to stay all night until Johnson came out. There were some who were not physically capable of staying up all night, such as A.J. Musty, and there were some that did not think that it would do any good. Decided, as a whole tone of in a participatory democracy, as the whole assembly was, that those that wanted to stay would stay, and those that wanted to leave would leave. About 15 stayed. Joan Baez left, just about everybody there was anybody left. What was left in both the picket line, the supporting picket line, and people that were sitting down were just us. Just the people who were going to dedicate their night to walking around or sitting down. I held many, many signs and I walked around all night. Now, during the night, many things happened. One person was arrested 2 times. One time, he tried to throw some sandwiches over the ring of cars. No, it was a water bottle over the ring of cars to the demonstrators. They got the water bottle, but it was taken away, and he was taken down to jail and arrested. He paid his $10 bond, was released, went back to the picket line with a bunch of blankets and sleeping bags, and tried to break through the line of cops to bring them the sleeping bags. He was again arrested, twice in one night. Then they hollered, we want more sitters. So about half of us that were picketing went and sat down. Now, they would not let anybody get closer than 10 feet. Their orders were not to let anybody join them. So we sat down next to them, 10 feet away. This was the first instance of police brutality I have ever seen in my life. was that night when one boy got what the policeman considered to be about 2-3 inches too close. He refused to move and immediately let his body go limp. Policemen used everything from their pointed shoes to their nightclubs to their hands on that kid. They lifted him up and threw him on top of us, and he weighed about 300 pounds. He immediately rolled back to the position he was in. They were kicking him and jumping on him and hitting him with their, both with their hands and with their nightsticks. And he just sat there. I don't even know his name. I found out later that this same type of thing was going on with the people that were sitting down inside the ring. The peculiar part of the whole thing was we couldn't see them and they couldn't see us. The cops were standing with their arms linked, almost two rows of them, almost overlapping. And we could not see a thing that was going on inside there, and they could not see a thing that was going on to us. And this was very frightening.
Nobody had a drink of water or anything that whole time.
Well, this was now about 2 in the morning. And most everybody went across to Lafayette Park and went to sleep. There were about 5 of us still on the picket line. And the ring of policemen had narrowed down. Then the new shift came on. What? 1 in the morning. The new shift came on. Now, these people were going to be very lenient. They were working overtime. They didn't get time and a half because there was no policemen's union. And all they wanted to do was get through the night. So they said to us and the demonstrators, listen, you be nice to us, we'll be nice to you. You don't make trouble for us, we won't make trouble for you. All right? And we said, all right. So they had 2 policemen, and later in the morning, no policemen guarding them, and no policemen guarding us, and they were sitting in the squad cars drinking coffee. And we were bringing coffee and things over to the demonstrators, talking with them, discussing what had happened that night. Then the police chief came about 5 in the morning, so they had to make some pretense of having a vigilant. So they made us leave, and we did. And this is what happened. The first vigil, everybody left at 8 o'clock in the morning. Those that had slept on the pavement had maybe gotten some sleep. Myself, I had been walking in circles all night, was just beat. We walked over to the Sylvan Theater, which is right next to the Washington Monument, an outdoor theater, which is, I don't know if it's a permanent structure or not, it looks pretty temporary to me, where they were doing some type of Shakespeare drama with the Shakespearean stage that was set up there. We all went back there and discussed the evening's happenings with each other. This was the day set aside for workshop.
This is Saturday now.
No, this is Saturday morning. So the day was set aside for workshops. I went to a workshop on PUAC, went to one on CEO, I went to one on the Free University. We received a list of all the workshops, and there were numerous. Just fantastically numerous, and nobody could attend all of them. The most important workshop of the entire was one that was not planned at all. It started extemporaneously. During the vigil in the sun on Friday, somebody passed a sheet of paper down the line saying, "Would everybody who is here from a local committee to end the war in Vietnam, please meet in Lafayette Park by the PA system at 8 o'clock this evening." I didn't attend because I was in a demonstration, but they decided they were going to have a workshop on Vietnam, or more exactly, on the Vietnam committees. That night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and possibly Monday if it was needed. This was the workshop that was by far the largest. It was an unplanned workshop, purely spontaneous. They set up a national coordinating committee to end the war in Vietnam, which is something that is needed and which is now set up. And it has a regular newsletter, which I have been receiving, called the Peace and Freedom Newsletter. It has now come out with 5 issues. Each and every one has been exactly 2 weeks apart. And they are excellent issues. And they are very much in need of money. They are spending about $500 a month, taking in about $25. They are now very much in debt, and they are not going to get much more credit. They are relied mainly on donations. Irving Kelman, who was one of the people that stayed all night on the vigil, was working very hard to try, since we didn't get to see President Johnson, to see President Johnson tonight in a similar time vigil. Well, it was set up, and everybody met in the same place, only this time it was about 10 times as many people.
Okay.
There was, I would say, about 50 people that were going to sit down, and about another 100 on the picket line. No, they were all sitting down in the main gate as before. And then we were informed, somebody said, "Irving, you want to see Johnson? Fine. Johnson's leaving." Helicopter was taking up from the front lawn. "He's going to Camp David to vacation." And he kind of said, "Oh." So he walked down to a phone booth and proceeded to call McNamara. No, he got to talk to McNamara's first assistant. He said, "What do you want?" And Irving said, "There are 2,000 people waiting in front of the White House to see Mr. McNamara. Will you give him this message?" "Yes." "Will he come and see us?" "The president has no appointment this evening. McNamara has no appointment this season. Evening, McNamara will come and see you." "All right, tell him we'll be waiting in front of the White House." "When will he come?" "I can't possibly say." Irving went back and told us this, and he told the police officer this. He said, "Can we stay here? We'll be arrested." And the officer said, "You can stay here today, stay here tomorrow, you can stay here a week, you can stay here a month. I don't care." Irving told us this. He says, "You're not going to get arrested. And we're waiting to see McNamara and present him with our declarations of conscience." Well, this was Sunday night. Saturday night. This was Sunday night, I think. This is Saturday night, right. Saturday night, we all, I'm trying to place this, was a long time ago, and Irving told us that there are 7 gates to the White House. We are blocking 1. We're not accomplishing anything. If we want to make things inconvenient, there are 6 other gates we have to block. So we proceeded slowly. Each gate took about an hour to block 5 of the remaining gates. There was 1 gate less unblocked. Now this gate, it was not blocked, was the security gate. In one end, and this gate was only accessible by an alley. One end of the alley was blocked off, so Irving and one married couple laid down and blocked off the other alley together. This time I had to leave because I found out that there was a person who was not an American citizen, and his story is very unusual, because he and one other person wrote 5 reasons why Negroes should not fight in Vietnam. Him and this other person are now facing trial for what they wrote.
They both Negroes?
No. One of them is. Now, this to me is a pretty obvious abridgment of freedom of the press. All they did was write something and get it published, and now they're facing trial for it. But they are. And this guy said, as long as I'm going to jail anyway, this is what I'm going to do. We are going to walk downtown Washington to the Pentagon building. We are going to sit in front of that Pentagon building until we get to talk to some military advisor, or we die, because we're going to fast. They had already been sitting there about 2 days.
Just the two of them?
Three of them. There was one other person. We drove down there, and we walked, drove into the main entrance, and there they were, sitting the other side of the parking lot, with a malt and a hamburger sitting in front of each of them. We drove up and we asked them, what are you doing? I thought you were fasting. And they said, we are fasting. That is just to show them, pointing to the Pentagon, that we are not kidding. Now, fasting is hard, but fasting with a malt and a hamburger sitting in front of you is fantastic. The reason we had gone over there is we brought them some sugar pills and some water, which they gladly accepted. I went back then to the White House, where the officers had promised there would be no arrest, and found that everybody had been arrested. 7 people had been arrested. Well, we immediately started organizing a picket line, and somebody came over from the jail saying they needed $500 bail for those arrested. So I immediately started collecting bail, both in loan and in donation. I took names and I promised everybody that if they wanted to, their money would be mailed back to them just as soon as possible. I had decided, and a bunch of other people said, that in this heat, there's just one way to stay cool, and it sounded insane. And as I found out later, it was very insane. He said, put on the hottest clothing you have, and believe it or not, it'll keep you cool. So I had this big sweatshirt on. It said, we shall overcome on it. And I was miserable because it was 104 degrees, which was, you know, this was one of the hottest summers.
Where did you get the
sweatshirt? It was Pat Brown's sweatshirt. She let me use it. It was the hottest summer, one of Washington's hottest summers, and I'm sure we picked the four hottest days. I'm sure of it. I mean, it was the middle of August. It was early August. Well, this was Sunday morning, and everybody was walking, and there were about 15 of us. Then somebody, as we were picketing, the cops came, and they had a restraining order. They said that we could picket, but no more than 5 people could join our picket line at a time. Well, this is kind of bad, and we didn't want any more arrested, and we just didn't know what to do. And I had collected now about $50, and a guy came over from the bail fund and asked for the money, and I gave it to him. I was kind of glad to get rid of it, because I was walking around with all these dollar bills in my hand. And I had gotten rid of it, and somebody said, running over to the Washington Monument, he says, who's sponsoring this? And I said, well, I'm kind of leading it. He says, all right. There's some people over in the Washington that want it, at the Washington Monument at the Sylvan Theater, who are willing to leave their discussion groups, because discussion groups are going on right now, if you want help, if you want more people. I said, bring them. He says, we don't know how we'll get around that restraining order, but bring the people. And I had hoped for maybe 10, 15 more people, because, you know, this was Sunday morning and tourists were walking by, and what did it look like to see 20 people marching around with signs? All of a sudden, I heard in the background a chant. End the war in Vietnam. Send the troops home. And this was fantastic. The biggest, you know, I expected 50 people. I said, maybe they're 75. 1,500 people marched around the corner. 1,500 people. Now, for the first time in the 3 days, the police officers were outnumbered. They had this restraining order. 5 people at a time. 5 people at a time. 1,500 people marched around with signs and started marching around the trees. And they couldn't arrest everybody. And we decided we'd call this a victory march, and we all marched back to the Washington Monument, and in one of the most fantastic things I've ever seen in my life, a double hand-linked circle, and not this hand-linked, upholded hands, linked, not crossed, but upholded. We completely, in a double circle, surrounded the Washington Monument, singing, "We Shall Overcome," for about an hour and a half. It was fantastic. And at the same time, policemen were going on the inner concrete circle in us on motorcycles, driving around and around, and park police were going on their horses outside of us, around and around us, and motorcycles were coming, you know, trying to hill climb up, getting up to us, and the policemen were just having a field day, you know, and the tourists with their cameras. There were people in the Washington Monument, and they were sitting on their benches, and they saw us coming, and they didn't make any attempt to leave. They sat back in their benches and started taking pictures of us. Oh. It was fantastic. We went back and discussed that day. And we've got, everybody got out of jail, we were told. But where was Irving? He led the thing, and he still is not in jail. We were sure he got arrested. We couldn't figure out where he was. Then that night, we were planning what to do the next day, because Monday was reserved for civil disobedience. This was Sunday evening. It started to get dark, and we had not decided. I got up and I spoke, and I recommended that to all 2,000 of us march down to the White House and go as far as we could until we were physically stopped by the police, and sit down and hold our Congress of Unrepresented People there, because this was the object.
The White House or the Capitol?
The Capitol. Did I say the White House? I'm sorry. The whole object was to hold this Congress of Unrepresented People and read the big Declaration of Peace and the smaller Declarations of Peace. Well, one lady got up and she said the reason she had come here was because she wanted to sit in her representative's seat within the state capitol, national capitol. Well, immediately, cameras clicked, notes began writing, and this one speech is what got publicized all over, from what I've heard, as the tone of the demonstration. They said these were a bunch of nuts that wanted to break into the Capitol and sit in their representative seats. This was one lady, and her suggestion was not even considered by the rest of the group. We decided, as a participatory democracy should decide, that those that wanted to keep going would keep going. The problem with Washington, with holding any kind of march in Washington, is there's 3 police forces that you have to deal with. There's the park police, whose jurisdiction the Washington Monument is, and most of the mall leading from the Washington Monument to the Capitol. Then there's the city police, the D.C. cops, whose jurisdiction is most of the city. Then there's the federal cops, whose jurisdiction is the Capitol grounds and the White House grounds. Well, at 3rd Street ends the Park Police's jurisdiction, and they told us that we had a permit with the Park Police only. And they told us that we could not go past 3rd Street. Well, we marched, and when we got to 3rd Street, the call came up and down the line. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going ahead of myself. This is, we decided that we would just go as far. Those of us that wanted to stop at 3rd Street, and we marched to 3rd Street, and those that wanted to stop at 3rd Street would stop at 3rd Street. Then it started to rain, and the rain came down in buckets. And a lot of people run for the thing, and one kid.
Was there a vigil Sunday night?
No, there wasn't. There was a teach-in Sunday night. They stood up. One person who had been leading the singing through most of it. No one knew who he was. He was somebody who had come up from Jackson, Mississippi. But he had a beautiful voice. And he was a beautiful man. With a beautiful goatee little beard. And he was just wonderful. And he stood up on the picnic table. And he started singing, "Wade in the Water." And everybody was standing there. And I was still in this We Shall Overcome sweatshirt. And I was soaking wet, and it's black, and of course it was running over everything that I owned and everything that I touched, and Robin was sitting next to me in a white thing, which was all covered with the black from my sweatshirt now, and everybody was singing Wade in the Water, and we sang it for about 45 minutes. He just made up verses, verse after verse, you know, and all movement verses. I don't know, this guy must... It was fantastic. He had a beautiful voice, and everybody was standing around the picnic table singing it, and he was standing on the picnic table. And the press people and the police people, who had immediately, as soon as the dribble came down, run to their police cars that were standing all around, were sitting in their police cars with the most puzzled looks on their faces, trying to figure out what kind of insane people would stand out in the rain singing for no reason and catch pneumonia. Well, it was kind of refreshing after a 102-degree day. And I think, you know, if we could have explained this to them. But they didn't really understand it.
How long did the rain keep up?
Well, we left when it was still just pouring after about 2 hours. I guess about an hour later, the rain stopped, and they held a teach-in. But I did not take part in the teach-in, or I wasn't there. I was dead tired. I hadn't been asleep in 3 nights. I'd been sitting in front of the state, in front of the White House. So I was dead tired. And Fran, who was the boy we were staying with, had thrown us out. He didn't really throw us out. I have to be fair to him. He had too many people staying with him. He really couldn't take us. And he had promised Washington Summer Action that when these people came up Saturday, and they didn't show up till Sunday, that he would take some people in. So he had to throw us out. But we got another place to stay that day. So we went there, Robin and I and Judy, and we did not know where Larry was. And we stayed there that night. The next morning, we had some problem. We couldn't find the keys to the car. And we had to get a guy to come and fix the keys to the car, and then it turned out later that Robin found them in her suitcase. So we wasted all that money getting keys made.
Oh, well, did Kalman ever turn up?
Pardon?
Kalman, what was his name, the other guy, did he ever turn up?
Irving.
Irving turned up that night in the rain, didn't I mention this? And Robin turned around and hollered, "Irving!" And I flipped out. And it turned out that Irving had been arrested about an hour before anybody else had, because he was blocking the security entrance with this married couple. Married couple had to leave, so Irving was alone. He had just laid, so motorcycles could make it through the security entrance, but no automobile could. He was laying like this, and he was arrested.
When did he get out?
They would not allow him a telephone call until that night. All day. They had a phone there, and he said, "Could I make a phone call?" And the cop would say, "You got a dime?" And it wasn't a pay phone. It was a regular phone. And Irving said, "No, I only have a nickel." He says, "Well, you need a dime to use our phone." And Irving said, "Well, it's not a pay phone. It's a regular phone." Finally, about 8 in the evening, a new cop came on duty, and Irving said, "Could I have a phone call?" And I said, "Haven't you had one yet?" He said, "No." So I said, "All right, have a phone call." So he got a phone call, and Frank came over, was the guy Irving and I were staying with, and paid his bail and got him out.
This is Monday.
Now, Monday morning, we thought we were going to be late because we had all this trouble finding the keys, but we weren't. And Eric Weinberger said, "Dave?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Here, take the names of everybody that's going to march today." So I started writing down names like Matt, everybody. Me and five other people together took down 2,500 names, and I couldn't figure out how we did it. And I found out later that I had forgotten to put my own name on. I had written down all of these names and addresses of all of these people that said they were going to march, and I had not put my own name on. I realized this after I started marching, but I said, oh, so what, you know? Well, we marched, and we marched to 3rd Street, where, as I said before, the park police had said we couldn't go. Call came up and down the line. Nobody's going to stop at 3rd Street. They can't arrest us all. We're going to keep going. So we kept going. And they said, we won't arrest you at 3rd Street anyway. You can go. As soon as they heard somebody holler that, you know, we won't arrest you. Because we were out of jurisdiction of the park police, and the D.C. cops said, we won't arrest you. Well, the D.C. cops' jurisdiction only extends from 3rd Street to 1st Street. After 1st Street, you're on federal property, so the federal cops have jurisdiction. So we stood at the edge of the 1st Street, and they said, anybody that crosses this street will be arrested. So about 50 people moved forward. He said, you won't be arrested. It was beautiful. He said, you will not be arrested. So they marched around, and Staunton Lynn, Bob, and Bob Moses were standing in the lead. And this was the time when the Nazis came by and threw red paint, and Dave Dillinger got it all over him, Staunton Lynn got it all over him, and Bob Moses, or Bob Parrish, got it all over him.
Is that you, Pat,
thank you? I got a little on my shirt, but I wasn't. I don't know if any of you have seen the picture in life.
Yeah,
you see how he was completely covered with red paint?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wasn't. I had a little red paint on my shirt, little spots of it. But, you know, those three were just completely covered with red paint. Well, those were, Bob Staunton Lynn said, draw me a line beyond which we cannot cross, and I'll cross it. And he was immediately arrested with Bob Moses.
Just for saying that.
Well, the cop said, you're a cross it. Take him off, you know? So everybody else marched around the corner to march up to the state capitol steps, the national capitol steps. And we met 500 police officers with their arms linked, standing across the gate.
These are federal police.
Federal police. And so they all sat down, and Judy Barnes looked and said, David! I said, what? Those are the same uniforms they have in Bogalusa! Those are the exact same colors! And it's true, I guess. I noticed the federal police have different uniforms than the D.C. or the park police do. And these were apparently the same uniforms that they had in Bogalusa.
That's just the term.
Same color uniforms.
About at the end of them.
Well, almost.
That doesn't take.
It's taping you guys.
Yeah, right now it's taping us. So, so we sat down and we read the Declaration of Peace in unison. And people stood up and started giving declarations of peace. Declarations of peace.
Do you have that? What is it? Is it very long?
I have it. Would you like me to get it?
Oh, I'd like to. I never read it after my...
Yeah, I don't think I have a copy I can give you. Maybe I do.
Well, you can read it on here. Yeah.
All right, I could do that. I have a copy downstairs. I think I can find it. And then individuals wrote declarations of peace. There was one from the Minnesota committee that Larry was going to read.
Well, you had your own.
Yes, and everybody had individual declarations of peace, and you were asked to prepare them, because the original declarations of peace, you see, CNBA wrote it, but when CNBA wrote it so that it would alienate no one that was against the war. For instance, if they just condemn violence, there are Marxists who don't condemn the violence of the Viet Cong, who only condemn the violence of the United States, and this would alienate these Marxists if you condemn violence. In your thing. But you didn't want to openly say that it was right,
yeah.
Violence, because it would alienate other people. It was very, very well worded so that everybody there agreed with it.
Did That's
a lot of people didn't think that it was strong enough, and so this is where people were recommended and asked to write their own individual declarations of peace. And it was stated that things said represented the opinions of not the majority, not even necessarily any more than just that one person that said it, unless he said that he represented a group. Well, during this, we had a white racist speak, said, who called himself an American, and another member of the American Nazi Party, who immediately walked up to Dave Dillinger, gave him a Hitler salute, and demanded that he be allowed to speak. Well, he did.
Let him speak?
Let him speak. Oh. And also the white racist was allowed to speak in his turn. He wanted to speak and be cut off, and Dave Dillinger said, "Now wait a minute, you want to take part in our assembly? Fine. But you take part in our assembly, and you just sit back and wait your turn, and you'll be called on." He says, this guy's next, and then it's your turn. Mr. What's your name again? Nazi. Mr. Nazi. And this other guy came in the seersucker coat, and he says, "I'm an American, and I want to speak." And this guy was a real nut, because when we were singing "We Shall Overcome," he says, "Why don't you communists sing it the right way? Isn't it 'We Shall Overcome America'? Isn't that what you mean? Isn't that what you're trying to say? 'You shall overcome America'?" And we were trying to sing, "We shall overcome." He'd holler, "America!"
Let's take a break and turn it over.
All right, but I just want to say that this American, the guy who called himself an American, was arrested with everybody else because he took part in the assembly.